From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. On today's show, hear about a unique and affordable college degree program that brought President Obama to Missouri this week.
I wanted to highlight what's happening here at University of Central Missouri.
Hear about the status of the old YMCA on Paseo, which the Negro Leagues Museum has been trying to renovate.
And I think at that time, Buck knew that he was sick, and this was going to be the swan song for Buck, and this was going to be the way that he set up his museum for continued prosperity and continued growth.
Plus, our creative couple for the week is from the Kansas City Ballet. And hear how women and girls are part of the rise of soccer here in town.
How we support the sport is a little bit different. You know, we're probably not going to take our shirt off and paint someone's number on our chest.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We bring you voices, stories, and sound, and take you to neighborhoods around the region. A Western Missouri-based educational program was the lure to bring President Obama to speak in Warrensburg last week. The president said so directly in his address at the University of Central Missouri. KCUR's Dan Verbeck heard the speech and talked with some originators of what's known as the Missouri Innovation Campus.
The president described the program as a jobs creator that speeds education for young people without leaving them saddled with student loan debt upon graduation.
That is why I wanted to highlight what's happening here at University of Central Missouri. Because you guys are doing some things right.
It began as a collaboration between Metropolitan Community College and a high school and some local businesses. It grew to include the university at Warrensburg and an accelerated college degree for students taking part. Mark James is the MCC chancellor. We talked outside the hall minutes after the president concluded his remarks. There were a lot of people around, and it was a little noisy.
When we got the word that what we were doing with the Missouri Innovation Campus had attracted the attention of the President of the United States, yes, it was a wow moment. We were so excited about the efforts that our faculty had put into it and our leadership team had put into it. And really, all along it was designed to try to do something new and unique that would be helpful to students. And so for the President, the White House, to take notice of that and choose to tout that in part of his comments, certainly we're very excited about that.
It sounds as though he would like to replicate this in a lot of other places around the country. Would they be surprised that it might be a little more difficult than they anticipate, or maybe it's not? Can it easily be done?
Well, it can be done. The easy part, maybe not. And what I mean by that is how we've been successful is that the key partners all left their egos at the door and focused on what's the best thing we can do for these students. And so when you have the Lee Summit R7 School District leadership committed to this, Metropolitan Community College committed to this, and the University of Central Missouri committed to this, those are three key educational ingredients, but none of this could happen without the business partners' commitment as well. And so that's where the challenge lies, is getting the excitement and the commitment of business partners. This needs to make sense for them from a business perspective. You know, how is this going to help their bottom line? And we are so fortunate here in Kansas City that we have these leaders in technology industries and the health industry who readily saw that this is a way to really help build tomorrow's workforce and do it now.
If it really takes off, will we wind up with a whole generation of people who are technically pure and are really good at doing that kind of jobs, but that's about all they can do?
Now the thing is, while these first cohort groups are focused on technology kinds of jobs and a health-related job, these students are taking their general education requirements like any other college degree. So they're taking the English and the math and the what have you. because to get an associate's degree with us, with Metropolitan Community College, and to get their bachelor's degree through University of Central Missouri, they are having to get that well-rounded education.
Not that narrow technical education that people used to talk about years ago.
Not the narrow. Now, they're, you know, obviously they're getting an opportunity to really get exposed in very different ways to the narrow technology pieces and actually be able to work in those industries in paid internships while being students. But that's not at the expense of a well-rounded general education that's going to develop, you know, both sides of that brain to help develop the critical thinking.
Chancellor James talked about the importance of getting businesses involved. Those firms include St. Luke's Health Systems, KCP&L, several engineering companies, and Cerner. Laura Evans directs talent development for that company. She said the genesis of the Innovation Campus left out the college degree component at first until UCM President Charles Ambrose got involved.
I think there are multiple pathways to get the well-rounded education that we think of. And today's student doesn't have a lot of patience for subject matter that feels irrelevant. And one of the things that helps them make that connection is work in a work environment where they see how the math, how the technology, how the more difficult academic classes help them accomplish the purposes at work. So I do think that this, it's just you're approaching things in a different order in a lot of ways. You're doing it more hands-on up front, and that keeps them engaged, and then they start to make those connections, and they also start to ask the questions, why? Why does this hands-on stuff work the way it does? So it goes beyond the, I can be the mechanic to, well, really, how does this work, and how could I make it work differently? That's
and,
my take.
And they can see immediately, or almost immediately, that they can make a pretty good wage.
Absolutely. Right. And they do, and that's probably the risk, that you help them understand that, you know, just learning the first layer gets you a good wage, but the long-term wage growth comes from going deeper, getting that broader critical thinking piece, in addition to the pure technical hands-on skills that you think of in a career in technology field.
As you say, that instant gratification for the young is pretty appealing to stick around for the better benefits down the line.
It is. But you know what's interesting? If you watch the interns, at least in our organization, they have a network of peers of all ages. And that network, their managers, the other people on their team, they are quick to help them understand both the short-term and the long-term options that they have and what consequences there might be if they sort of say, yeah, this is good enough. And I find that the network that they develop and the professional coaching and mentoring that they get is probably helping them fully develop as much as any classroom component or the actual hands-on work that they do, as you might imagine.
Laura Evans, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
The MIC, the Innovation Campus Program, takes its beginning high school students from all three Lee Summit High Schools and seven other districts. For KC Currents, I'm Dan Verbeck, KCUR News.
The last time Congress raised the federal minimum wage was 4 years ago. Last week's anniversary of that legislation has prompted many to push for higher minimum wages around the country in places like Fort Lauderdale, Seattle, and Boston. Here in Kansas City, church activists have been organizing their own fight for higher wages and greater economic opportunity. On Thursday evening in the Washington Wheatley neighborhood, they held a rally to build support for their cause. Alex Smith was there and brought us this audio snapshot.
A A small gospel combo welcomed visitors to the True Vine Baptist Church on Thursday evening. Sitting in the pews, retired Pastor Wallace Hartsfield explained what brought him to the event.
Jobs. our young men, especially our young men, need jobs. And to get them off of the street, and many things will not happen if these guys have jobs.
Father God, we come right now thanking you, Lord, for this day. We thank you for every blessing that you have bestowed upon us.
Pastor Artist Taylor welcomed an audience of about 60 and started the evening with a prayer. Taylor is head of the True Vine Church, which hosted Thursday's rally and community prayer. The event was organized by Communities Creating Opportunity to bring people together in support of racial and economic justice and more opportunities for lower-income Kansas Cityans. Among the speakers was fast food worker Wilma Brown, who took the podium to tell her story of struggles working in the fast food industry.
I work paycheck to paycheck. I struggle to feed myself and my son, pay rent, utilities. I can no longer afford a car.
Several pastors took turns speaking, and some, like Reverend Herbert Davis, brought the fire of Sunday morning to the podium.
But if we're going to make a change, that change, young people, has got to start with you. Do not look at your situations. Don't look at your mama, your daddy, your education, your economic situation, but you point the finger at yourself and say, what can I do to make a change in myself? Because they don't give you a job. They offer you a job. Some of you too dang on lazy to even work at McDonald's.
Some critics say that moves like raising the minimum wage would place a crippling burden on employers, especially during troubled economic times. But rallier Norma Reed believes many low-wage workers suffer unsustainable conditions, and now's the time to act.
We don't want it to get any worse, so this is a good time.
While the event was planned before the George Zimmerman verdict, his acquittal wasn't far from the minds of many. Pastor Stevie Wake said that he and his congregation were looking for constructive ways to deal with the anger that the verdict fueled.
It's something that many congregations have committed to talk about as a result of the verdict, as something that we need to make sure that we respond in a way that's going to bring change.
Philip Rhodes drove in from Overland Park to attend the service.
We're all concerned after the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman trial, and it looked like this was a positive thing to do to try to solve problems that, that whole incident pointed out in our society.
If you're ready to stand up, speak out, and be heard, let me hear you say, ready.
Ready.
And if you're ready, if you're ready, mm-hmm. if you're ready, uh-huh. if you're ready, uh-huh. then let's get to work.
After leading a rallying call, Pastor Taylor took the congregation out in the street to march and sing. As the sun began to set, the rally ended with heads bowed as Taylor led a final prayer.
And now we pray your divine guidance as we move forward from this point to making a difference in our community.
Organizers say they're planning more events in the next few months to encourage higher wages and more economic opportunity. The next is a march in support of fast food and retail workers at Gillum Park on Tuesday afternoon. For Casey Currents, I'm Alex Smith.
Coming up, Kansas City, Missouri kicks in $500,000 to help make Buck O'Neill's dream a reality. You're listening to Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. For 18 years, the old YMCA building was an eyesore at the entrance of the 18th and Vine District. But over the last few years, the facade has been restored and the windows replaced. And on the south wall, a giant mural has gone up of the legendary baseball player, coach, and keeper of the Negro League's flame, Buck O'Neill. The building belongs to the Negro League's Baseball Museum. Officials there have long planned to turn it into the Buck O'Neill Education and Research Center. They got a step closer to that goal this week when the city council voted to allocate $500,000 to help restore the inside of the building. To find out more about the history of the building and the plans for the old Y, I went down to the Negro Leagues Museum this week to meet with President Bob Kendrick.
Andrew Root Foster led a contingent of 8 independent black baseball team owners into Kansas City, and they met at the old Paseo YMCA. Out of that meeting came the birthplace of the Negro National League, the first successful organized black baseball league. The leagues would go on to operate for 40 years and give, obviously, a playing ground for the best African-American and Hispanic baseball players to showcase their world-class skills, but it would also have a tremendous impact in the social advancement of our country. And so that historic landmark was the site of that meeting, and so many other legendary African-Americans stayed at the Paseo YMCA. It was the only place where black folks could swim at that time and do these other recreational kinds of things. And so that building has great historical significance, even beyond the fact that the Negro Leagues were established there.
And that happened in 1920?
Yes, the leagues were formed in 1920. The building opened in 1914. So it is one of the oldest African-American YMCAs in the country. Not the oldest, but certainly one of the oldest African-American YMCAs in the country. And when we get it functioning again, it will be one of only, I think, 2 of those old African-American YMCAs that will actually be functioning.
And the YMCA, was that unusual for them to start both black and white institutions?
Most of those white YMCAs didn't allow blacks, you know, to utilize them. And so I think there was great sentiment that there was need for a facility that would allow African-Americans to have an opportunity to recreate. And so that's how these emergences of these YMCAs started to come about.
And when did it close, the one on the Paseo here?
This one has been closed since probably the early mid-70s. It's been unoccupied, and so it was boarded up and abandoned, really. And it was an eyesore to the community, harboring illicit activity. Vagrants were living in the building, and, you know, and they were trying to do things to stay warm and started fires in the building and this kind of thing. And so when we took on this project, we also cleaned the building up. And so Ollie Gates, who has become kind of the champion of this project, the Buck O'Neill Center.
That's, of course, Ollie Gates of Gates Barbecue, yes. Kansas City's barbecue magnate.
Absolutely. The barbecue baron, as I like to refer to him, too, has taken the leadership on this project, got that building cleaned up, got rid of a lot of the blight that was in and around the building. And so now we have a beautiful shell. But it is something that the community has embraced and responded to because they're taking pride in the fact that this old abandoned building that was such an eyesore has become this beautiful swan now. And even though it's just a beautiful shell, it has totally transformed the community.
How would just having the outside of the building transform the community?
Well, we got rid of that blight. You know, you got rid of that blight and you got rid of the stuff that was going on in and around that building. And in the process, what we saw was that the community took great ownership in this project. They were so excited to see that all eradicated. And so now as you drive down the Paseo, if you start coming off of I-29 south at the Paseo and you drive south on the Paseo, it is absolutely beautiful. It is a beautiful boulevard. The only eyesore on the boulevard was the old YMCA building. And so now that we've alleviated that and created this and preserved the building, you know, there's no further risk of structural deterioration of the building. So really, it wasn't a matter of if the building was going to fall in at some point in time. It was just a matter of when.
Who was the first person to come up with the idea that that building should be renovated and turned into some kind of education or museum center?
Well, it had been on the, I guess, on the docket for the museum for quite some time. We probably started talking about that in the late 1990s, early 2000s, about the possibility of the museum taking ownership of the Paseo YMCA and converting it into an education and research center in celebration of Buck O'Neill, who was still with us at that time, and Landon Rowland, who has been a longtime board member of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum and a tremendous friend of the museum, purchased that building and donated it back to the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum so that we could start the development efforts to create an expansion of our great museum.
And what is an education and research center? What does that mean?
Well, it means several things for the museum. You know, one of the things is that we've outgrown our current home. So we have this wonderful attraction. The Buck O'Neill Education and Research Center gives us an opportunity to function more now as an institution with an attraction. So we can start to look at Negro Leagues baseball in much greater depth, a facility where people can come in and learn in greater detail this history, whether they are students, whether they are scholars, if you're writing your thesis or what have you. So the goal is to, at some point in time, house the entire archives of those great black papers, which became the voice of the Negro Leagues, a place where those who are researching Negro Leagues can have their papers and books. So we have a one-stop shop that we essentially have a central repository for Negro Leagues history, but it also creates an opportunity for us for expanded exhibits because there's still a lot of stories that need to be told. We're looking at cutting-edge technology and curriculum-based opportunities that address the math and science of baseball and administrative office space. So there are a number of things that this building will give us the opportunity to do as we look at the next two decades of growth for the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum and beyond.
And has that idea changed over the years since you first thought about what it would be?
Yeah, and it'll probably continue to change because we want to make sure, number one, that we maximize every nook and cranny in that building to meet our specific needs. But, you know, when we first started the project, it was about a $15 million project because it was going to include an annex that had some other things that were really neat at that time. But, you know, the economy really started to suffer and it was going to be too difficult for us to go out and try and conduct a $15, $17 million capital campaign in this climate. And so we backed off of some of those plans. And again, with the help of Mr. Gates, who obviously is a great businessman in his own right, great civic leader, and very philanthropic in his own rights, he's been able to kind of lean on his friends who have helped move this project along. And so we were able to get a lot of work done with a little resources. And so we've done it phase by phase.
Tell me what Buck O'Neill's plans were for the building.
Well, it wasn't as much as him having a plan per se, more so of him having a desire to educate young people. You know, Buck, who I call one of the greatest teachers ever, even though he wasn't a teacher by trade, you know, here's the grandson of a slave who lived through some incredible circumstances, who never harbored any bitterness, who never harbored any ill will toward any human being, who taught us all about living and loving, and taught us about the heroes of the Negro Leagues, taught us how to lose with dignity and grace. You know, he taught all of these wonderful things that continue to resonate. And so, but at the core of that for him was education. You know, he would oftentimes say that education is like a garden growing in your mind. And for that garden to grow, you got to water it. And so the Education and Research Center was going to become this area that waters those young minds as we teach them about not only the virtues and history of the Negro Leagues, but in doing so, help them prepare better for life. And I think there are things that transcend from the Negro Leagues that become wonderful teaching tools, you know, because the story itself was never a woe is mine kind of story. This weren't about men who were out there crying about social injustice. They went out and did something about it. And those are lessons that never go out of style. They will transcend time. They transcend race and gender. And so he felt compelled that this story could be used as a teaching tool. Because with young people, you have to make it relevant to what is happening in their world today. They're very savvy. You know, they'll say, that was then, this is now. So how does this apply to me? And we have to be able to address that. And we needed the space in order to do that, to continue to create innovative programs that stem from the teachings of the Negro Leagues.
The great disappointment when he was not inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame, that was a setback for the Research Center, too.
Yes, it was. And, you know, here we are almost 7 years, you know, since Buck's death and that dreadful decision that happened in February of 2006. And, you know, we were all prepared. You know, we everybody thought that this thing was a shoe-in, that Buck is going to get in. And so we had prepared, you know, to launch this capital campaign in around Buck's Hall of Fame induction and his whole nine yards. And something crazy along the way happened, and it didn't happen. And so it did set the project back. And, you know, and it was devastating to all of us who love Buck. And obviously Buck handled it with such grace, class, and dignity, but he was certainly disappointed. You know, the Hall of Fame represents the pinnacle for any athlete. And I think at that time, Buck knew that he was sick. And this was going to be the swan song for Buck. And this was going to be the way that he set up his museum for continued prosperity and continued growth. And so there was a great level of disappointment for him. He didn't show it publicly, didn't display it publicly. He took it like a man, you know. And as a result, we all learned a valuable lesson from Buck on how to handle disappointment. And so, but yeah, it did set the project back. And so we had to regroup. And we did that, you know, while he was still with us. But then in October of that same year, he passed away. And we knew that Buck's death would be the most significant thing to ever happen to the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. And we were right. You know, it was tremendous to lose your both spiritual leader, you know, the guy who could command the attention of a lot of people. He was the guy that could pick up the phone and call the commissioner of baseball, and the commissioner is going to take his call. You know, so, and to use a probably a bad baseball analogy, losing Buck was like losing your power hitter. You know, you can't take your power hitter out of your lineup and think that you're going to be as offensively potent as you were when he was in your lineup. So now you have to find ways to manufacture runs. And that's what we saw ourselves in a position to have to do after we lost Buck. But no one was expecting to lose Buck. You know, it's rare that a 94-year-old man dies and you're surprised. But Buck O'Neill had defied age for so long. He was so charismatic, so gregarious and vivacious that you just didn't think he was ever going to die. If anybody was going to make 100 or better, it was going to be Buck. And so I think we were all caught off guard by his untimely death, and so it kind of set the wheels spinning for us, and so we had to regroup.
And how did the fundraising go? This week, the city council approved $500,000 for the research center, but you have raised a total of $3 million, is that
over
right?
Over time. And, you know, yeah, this week we were in front of the Finance Committee of the City Council endorsing an ordinance that had been presented to put $500,000 dedicated to this project to advance the continued development of the Buck O'Neill Education and Research Center. And it is my understanding that on Thursday of this week, the City Council also unanimously approved these funds. And so that is a ringing endorsement for this project, which we hope will resonate with the funding community as we continue to try and leverage this particular gift to raise the dollars necessary to complete this project. But we have great aspiration that we will have at least two floors of this building functioning by fall of next year. And when I say functioning, where the public can actually come into it and feel it and embrace it and have activity going on in that building. And of course, 2014 marks the 100th anniversary of the opening of the Paseo YMC. So there's great synergy and great timing in trying to meet that goal.
Now, I want to ask you about the 18th and Vine District in general. There's been this perennial question about how to make the entire district more of an attraction, bring more businesses, have more places for people to go besides the two museums here. Where do you feel the district is at now?
Well, I think the district is moving in the right direction. You know, from a commercial development standpoint, I don't think the commercial stuff has happened as fast as we would all like. I think we were all hoping that we'd have a plethora of other commercial opportunities. But the district, I think, is doing well. And it's all about patience. This wasn't the easiest sale to attract commercial developers to come into. But, you know, for a community to sustain itself, you have to have the basic kinds of things. You need a grocery store. You need banking institutions. You need dry cleaners. You need drug stores. Because this is indeed a community. You know, it's not just an entertainment district. And I think sometimes that gets lost in the equation. People are living here. There are children who are growing up here. There are families who have made 18th and Vine their home. And so you need those sustaining kinds of mechanisms in place. And for me, again, another bad analogy, but it's almost like which comes first, the chicken or the egg. And so you needed density. You know, you needed that in order to start to attract these folks to come in and anchor and set up here. I think we've created that density now. You know, the housing aspect of this has been way ahead of pace. You know, it's such a great district. People are living here. The great activity here, great culture. We have this cultural campus with these two museums and the Black Archives. And now we're trying to do our part with the redevelopment of the Pacell YMCA and the Buck O'Neill Education and Research Center, which in some ways will start now development moving west of the historic 18th and Vine District. There's no reason that we can't create enough synergy that 18th and Vine and the Crossroads District should eventually connect. And so, you know, again, that is certainly long term, but I feel very good about the work that has gone on here at 18th and Vine and the direction that 18th and Vine is going.
Well, Bob Kendrick, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you, and thank you for having me again.
Bob Kendrick is president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Kearns today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes. Americans eat millions of pounds of fish and seafood, and government figures show that more than 80% of it is imported. But aquaculture doesn't require an ocean. Reporting from Iowa for Harvest Public Media, Pat Blank has the story of a couple of cousins hoping to find a place in that market by farming fish in a part of the country where pork is king.
Jeff and Mark Nelson have raised corn and hogs for years, but they were looking to diversify their operation. Farm-raised fish in Iowa has been tried before, but with limited success. It involved outdoor ponds and mostly catfish. The Nelsons have moved their venture inside.
An old hog barn, which used to have 10 rooms, and we've gutted out all the rooms, so we basically have, it's basically a building with a 10-foot ceiling.
Jeff Nelson says after 3 years of research and traveling all over the country to see how others were doing it, they began raising hybrid striped bass in 18 10,000-gallon tanks on their farm just outside Blairsburg.
We start out with about 12,000 fish in a tank. Once they get so big, they're graded for size plus the density in the tank. We want to keep the density down so there's plenty of room for them. And so they're graded twice, so by the time they're market ready, there's probably around 3,000 fish in the tank.
The fish are automatically fed a high-protein soy mixture between 6 and 10 times a day, which keeps the food from being wasted and keeps the buildup in the tanks to a minimum. And once they've reached the appropriate size, they're shipped to restaurants and a processor in Minnesota.
A lot of times if it's shipped to them from another location, 3 to 5 days is what they have to get it served. Whereas we've heard them say that 10 days after they've gotten our fish, it's still as fresh as the day they got it.
If you've ever had an aquarium, you know that keeping it clean can be a hassle. But in this case, the water is put through a recirculation process. Iowa State University aquaculture specialist Alan Petillo.
And we filter the solids waste out of the water and then run through a biological filter. And that changes all the toxic parts of the water into non-toxic components. And so we can continue to use that water over and over again. And then effluent water can then go out into the environment. It's much, much more dilute than any other style of livestock.
Petillo was one of the experts giving the Nelsons advice. Because the operation is the largest fish-for-food facility in the state, they've gotten a lot of attention. Patillo and others have written a few grants to help bolster the aquaculture industry in Iowa.
Our goal is to create a vertically integrated type cooperative system so that we can have a feed processor as well as a fish processor and a lot of different fish farmers around the area.
That idea makes a lot of sense to Ray Hansen, who directs ISU's value-added agriculture program. He says last year's drought and this year's wet weather have many farmers looking for ways to diversify.
Certainly it's difficult and challenging to find, let alone afford, adding ground to increase your farming operation. And there's pretty significant expense in starting or operating a new livestock operation. So this is kind of an interesting and unique twist on how can you get involved or expand your farming operation with something that we're just not used to seeing in this area.
The Nelsons are still experimenting. They've installed a tank in another part of the barn and are attempting to raise shrimp. They still custom feed hogs in addition to growing corn and soybeans, but Jeff says he believes he's found the best part of doing chores on the fish farm.
One thing nice about coming in here, your clothes don't smell when you leave.
For Harvest Public Media, I'm Pat Blank.
After the break, a look at the role of women in Kansas City's soccer renaissance. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Major League Soccer's All-Star Game is in Kansas City this week. And with all the hoopla, it's become clear nationally that our soccer star is on the rise. And whether it's on the pitch or along the sidelines, girls and women are finding their niche in the game. KCUR intern Sangeeta Shastri has this story.
What's that cap?
Sound familiar? You might have played on a team just like this one when you were growing up. Or maybe these are the sounds you hear when you shuttle your kids to practices and games. This city is no stranger to soccer. Just this past week, the Overland Park Soccer Complex hosted the 2013 U.S. Youth Soccer National Championships. In 2010, the rebranding of the Wizards to the beloved Sporting Kansas City sparked an interest that's only going to get bigger, according to those who follow the game. And not just for men, either. From high school competitions to the premier and professional teams that both planted their flags in Kansas City just last year, girls and women are finding ways to make their mark on and off the pitch.
The social side of soccer is huge, and I think it actually plays even a larger role with girls and females.
That's Shane Hackett. He's into his 10th year as the executive director of the Heartland Soccer Association, a league that covers more than 1,100 teams in Johnson County. Not only did Hackett play at William Jewell College in Liberty, he raised five players, too.
You're also talking to a father of five, and I have four strong girls.
Another man, Sean Doherty, jokes that he blames his mom for getting him interested in starting his own team. She played college basketball during the Title IX movement, which taught Doherty that if given the opportunity, everyone has the ability to be great, he says. But at the professional level, he didn't see a lot to aspire to for young women playing competitively in Kansas City.
We all know that Kansas City has become really a soccer mecca of the United States, but there was no women's teams here at all. There was nothing in Nebraska, Kansas, or Missouri. It just didn't even exist.
So, about 18 months ago, Doherty put into action a plan he'd been tossing around since 2009, the idea of starting a women's premier soccer league team right in his own backyard. And so, the Kansas City Shock was born. Doherty's the chief executive officer.
After the failure of the second professional women's soccer league, it kind of created a vacuum for women's soccer programs at an elevated elite level.
Shane Hackett of the Heartland Soccer Association knows the feeling. When he was playing, there wasn't a professional outdoor soccer team in the city, and there weren't many American players traveling overseas to keep competing.
But now there's this ability for, you know, for us to dream and aspire to become a Sporting KC player or an FCKC player to be able to play on the women's side. So I think it's great for dreaming, and I think it helps shape the culture.
He's talking about FC Kansas City, the professional women's team that was founded here last year. By all accounts, soccer is spreading. The simplicity of the game helps, as does the land around Kansas City to build fields, space some cities just don't have, Hackett says.
I see, you know, the women's side and the girls' side of soccer continuing to grow. It continues to get bigger.
After scouting college and high school teams, the Kansas City Shocks roster now sits at about 25 to 30 players, with 16 to 18 of those women traveling. But Sean Doherty says it's a more diverse bunch than you might think.
We got a ton of local players. What we didn't necessarily account for was the fact we were also going to be represented by seven different countries. They came out of everywhere. We were fielding questions from Serbia, Jamaica, Australia, Mexico. It just, everybody came out. We're like, well, all right, let's see if we can make this work.
Women are finding their niche on the sidelines, too.
I'm Barbara Goebel, and I'm one of the early members of Ladies of SKC, a supporters group specifically for women that supports Sporting Kansas City.
I'm one of the founders of WUFC, Women United Football Club.
That's Christy Colvin. She founded WUFC with six other women.
Which is women across the world, ultimately, that love football, footy football.
There were a lot of like-minded women that kind of came together and said, hey, we not only love the sport, but we like community interaction. So Ladies of SKC is kind of built on that.
We want to be that safe landing spot where someone can ask the stupid question.
The women of Ladies of SKC and WUFC often cheer in the Cauldron, a holdover from the Wizards and the largest umbrella fan group for Sporting Kansas City. Even though they feel completely welcome there, Christy Colvin and Barbara Goebel say that for them, enjoying soccer as women is simply a different experience.
Women who love football and soccer tend to be a little religious about it, and it takes over your whole life often. Sometimes you have your children playing, you are married to a soccer player, or you just love the team and you're a season ticket holder. And so a lot of your girlfriends don't really relate to that. So we went to develop a community of people who related to both the love of going shoe shopping and the need to go and tailgate and support their favorite team. So it's a little strange that I balance both sides of my personality with this extreme, you know, I'm going to kill people if they hurt our guys kind of attitude, and then like, oh, pretty purse.
There is a very kind of female way of communicating often where we kind of try to soften our opinions a little bit.
Those differences extend to the sidelines, too.
How we support the sport is a little bit different. You know, we're probably not going to take our shirt off and paint someone's number on our chest because, first of all, we probably wouldn't be allowed in.
That would be supported by the
yeah.
Cauldron, I can tell you.
Yeah,
that.
It probably would be. A lot of people would probably love that, in fact. But, you know, it's not our typical mode of expression. Before a game, we're often, a lot of people do say things to the players and things, but women are especially nurturing with them, you know, like, now be safe on the pitch, you know, no injuries today, you know, where guys are like, go kill them. So it's just, I think these groups and their acceptance by the teams themselves, by MLS, by people who write about soccer in the industry, it has significantly given us the confidence to keep expressing ourselves.
It's more integrated in our everyday life, maybe, than a sports passion is for a lot of other fans. I think that there is the whole support element. You know, we know who our fellow fans are. You know, if somebody's having a baby, then we provide meals. If somebody loses a spouse or a parent or a friend, everybody's there to support them through that. So there's a lot of emotional connection that goes way beyond the sport.
The league teams, the professional teams, the fans who welcome newcomers with open arms, they all come together to create what Barbara Goebel calls a whole-consuming passion. And now, she says, that's spilling over into women's teams, too.
As my daughter was coming up, we didn't watch any women's soccer aside from leading up to Olympics. That's all we knew. Now, especially with two women's soccer teams in Kansas City, it is very exciting, the possibilities for young women to see role models in their sport, to see where they can go with their athletic abilities is awesome. It's a fantastic thing.
That's the heart of what the sport should be, Kansas City Shock owner Sean Doherty says. A path for players like his to grow.
I want them to say, I'm going to play like that. I'm going to be an amazing athlete.
It's all about spreading the game for everyone. For Casey Currents, I'm Sangeeta Shastri.
Tune in Wednesday morning at 10 to Central Standard for a special broadcast about the Major League Soccer All-Star Game here in Kansas City this week.
The work of the iconic Mexican artists Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera is on display this summer at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. They're part of an exhibit called Frida Kahlo, Diego Rivera, and Masterpieces of Modern Mexico.
Kahlo and Rivera are known not only for their paintings, but also for their tempestuous marriage, which sometimes inspired their art. So, inspired by Kahlo and Rivera, over the next month on Casey Currents, we're profiling a few of Kansas City's creative couples. We want to find out how two artists make a life together and how their relationship influences their work.
Julie Denishay produced this profile of two artists who met as teenagers in the Boston Ballet Summer Program. For over a decade, they've performed with the Kansas City Ballet. She's often described as elegant. He's boldly energetic. They say they relish the opportunity for a pas de deux, or dance for two. Here they are in their own words.
I was immediately drawn to Logan. Logan is a fiercely individual person, and there's just something about him that I knew I wanted to be near. My name is Rachel Coates. I dance for the Kansas City Ballet, and I am married to Logan Pichars.
My name is Logan Pichars. I dance with the Kansas City Ballet. This is my 13th season here. I'm married to the beautiful Rachel Coates, and this is our 8th year of marriage. I think she tries to inspire me, especially when I'm kind of like going through the dregs or feeling down on myself or things are becoming a little too hard. She's always there to support me and to lift me up when I'm having a hard time.
Dancing-wise, we're often well aware of our flaws, and one of the things that I'm always very hard on myself. It's a common ballerina thing, ballet dancer thing. We're often all perfectionists, and surprise, you can't be perfect all the time. It's impossible. So I can be kind of hard on myself, kind of down, and whenever I get in that mode, he's always there. I think it's something that we do for each other in our different ways. We kind of bring the other one back to where they need to be. So I couldn't ask for a more supportive partner in dance and in life.
I would always like the ability to dance with my wife. I would like to do that all the time, but you know, a lot of things are very role specific, body type specific. But when I do get the opportunity to dance with my wife, I tend to take it to the next level, just because I know it's with my wife.
What does the next level mean?
It could be romantic in nature, mm-hmm. Or it could be just trying to expand our technical growth as individuals, as dancers.
I also like it when we get to dance emotional roles together, because there's a certain level of comfort I think that we feel when we dance together. For instance, something that occurred to me one day, we were doing a role and I was supposed to have my hands on his shoulder, and I didn't even realize where my hands were, because it was just, if it were someone else that I wasn't maybe as comfortable with, I would be kind of very aware of how I was touching this person. But with Logan, it's kind of second nature, so I say that only to show that we just have a very comfortable nature, a very strong bond.
In our type of relationship, I mean, everything is on the table all the time. But I think it's having the awareness of and being sensitive to the fact that if somebody is having a bad day, you don't go up and give them a correction for having a bad technique for something. I mean, it's just not something you do. It's just you know that you're sensitive to the other person's emotions.
When we first met, we were 17 and 18, so we've evolved as artists and as people in every possible way. I mean, we survived our 20s together. So, and the cool thing is that...
What there was of it.
everything we've done it together. So there's no way to talk about the artist that I've become or that he's become without thinking of the other person, because it's not just one thing. It's like you said, it's all intertwined. It's all, we're part of each other. That's just what it is.
Dr. That was Rachel Coates and Logan Pichar's wife and husband and dancers for the Kansas City Ballet. We'll be airing stories about more of Kansas City's creative couples over the next 4 weeks. Find photographs of the couples, as well as some special online-only stories, on our website at kcur.org.
We appreciate you tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived, along with all of our past shows, on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at KC Currents.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia with associate producer Alex Smith. Our interns are Ryan Schisler and Monica Sandretsky. Our theme music is by Approach. And as always, I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.